Welcome to another episode of the Verity Life Poetry Podcast. I'm Alice Allen. Every month we interview a poet who's been published in the journal and we discuss a poem that's important to them. And this month we have a special episode talking about the work of Ben Frater, a Campbelltown-based poet who passed away in 2007. I had the chance to talk with Tim Heffernan, a Wollongong poet who's been inspired by Ben's work, and Elise Blaney, Ben's partner and a poet herself. Elise put together the playlist that I'm drawing on for this episode. We start out by hearing about Tim's upcoming workshop, Mad Poets.
On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand.
The Mad Poets workshop is part of the Wollongong Writers Festival, which has been going for, I think, 3 or 4 years now. And I've been working with Linda Godfrey, who's the program manager, on getting this up. And we're doing a double thing. We're doing the workshop, and then we're doing, in November, when the actual festival's on, we're going to have a panel of Mad Poets and some readings. And a reprise of a wonderful poet called Ben Frater. So the workshop itself is meant to be just a place where people who have experienced individual or societal madness can get together and write. But I think it's being very much informed by the poetry or the man Ben Frater and some of his desire to, when he was alive, to create a space where people could, who were writing poetry, waiting for medication, could sit down and do that at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. So what you were mentioning there about writing and sharing poetry while waiting for medication, maybe Elise, do you want to expand a little bit on what Ben was doing with that?
Yeah, sure. So he would have to go to the clozapine clinic at Banks House to pick up his medication. And that, back in those days, that involved waiting around for a few hours while the people would have to get their blood test results done so they could check the white blood cell level count. And then they'd have to wait on a courier to come back to check that it was okay for them to be prescribed the medication. So there was probably 3 to 4 hours wait. And Ben noticed that a lot of the people waiting for their medication were getting, you know, frustrated, quite almost angry. It was a long wait. So he wanted to start a poetry workshop within the hospital while people were waiting. And he actually spoke to his caseworker about this, who he agreed was actually quite a great idea. So he started planning ideas for what he would include in these poetry workshops. And I sent him some of the photographs from his notebook in which he was planning all of this. But unfortunately, it never got off the ground because he became more unwell.
And so, yeah, Tim, so, is your workshop going to be using some of those same techniques?
Well, you know, being a good poetry workshop planner, I've been thinking about what sort of activities I could do to bring this thing together. And it's just happened recently that Elise shared this detail about the clozapine workshop that Ben was planning. But I think for me, the whole thing about the Mad Poetry workshop is it's been very important in my life just to get poetry about our different experience of life, of things, out there into the mainstream, and to do this sort of stuff within a mainstream writers' festival is just incredibly important to me. My own experience of madness goes back to the 80s with my first experience of psychosis as part of my, now I understand, bipolar mood disorder. But poetry has always been very important to communicate to the world how I feel in an artistic and powerful way, but also to sort of, I suppose, a little bit therapeutic in a way that I can go back and make sense of experiences that have been a little bit different to the mainstream. But I want them to be out there in the mainstream, not locked into just a sort of a subculture madness sort of space. I think it's very important that we are out there, and in doing so, both Elise and I work in mental health as peer support workers. We're very concerned about reducing stigma, getting people's recovery to be the fullest possible, and that means participating in the real world.
Yeah, I think there is still just an amazing amount of stigma around mental health, even though the conversation is progressing very quickly. And I'm really interested in our attitudes towards mental health and the way that intersects with our attitudes towards poetry. And I think there is still very much in operation this myth of the romantically mad poet. And obviously that's very different to the very unromantic reality of dealing with a mental health issue. Like what you were describing there, Elise, spending hours and hours waiting for blood test results to come back so you can get medication. What do you think, Elise, about the way that we kind of, we prize this idea of the mad poet, but we don't actually have much time for the people who actually have to deal with these issues?
I find it quite extraordinary, really. I think Hollywood has been romanticising that idea of the mad poet and writer for many years, and I think that's kind of been reinforced into kind of mainstream culture. But when you actually know somebody who's, struggling with emotional and mental health issues, and you've had a lived experience of that yourself, you quickly become to see that, you know, it's not glamorous at all. In fact, it's very far from anything glamorous. There's quite a lot of trauma, I'd say. There's a lot of traumatic experience that goes with it.
Yeah, and Tim, would you say that in writing with this issue of mental health in the forefront, what's the relationship between letting out that madness and creating work that has structure and that has a kind of strong form behind it, I suppose?
I think it's... it's a thing where often with an illness called bipolar or the old manic depression you were talking about, a lot of creativity does happen when you're manic and not sleeping and finding all the connections that life brings to you, the incredible way it evolves. But a lot of that stuff's very loose and goes out into the ether, and you lose it, I suppose. So it's really a matter of coming back to those experiences, I think, in retrospect, and sitting down and using some of that that material, because there is good ideas there. There are wonderful ideas there, but they don't have that structure. So often for me, it's a process that it can be a decade or more of work to bring back some of those memories, some of those experiences, and put them into a form that's strong, that is that stands up as poetry, and doesn't just seem to be the sort of the irregular, haphazard rantings of a mad person. So I think it's very important to me. Not all my poetry or Elise's poetry or Ben's poetry was about being mad. It was about how we connect with this universe, how we connect with this world, how we connect with other people. And so often most of our poetry's got nothing to do with madness, but occasionally we need to articulate this space that we've been in. And, you know, as Elise has said, it has been overly romanticized, I suppose, but I do believe people who have some experience of mental health issues or mental illness do have a different way of connecting with the planet, with the universe. And so often I think the ideas that can come from that can be quite different to others. And I think as we get into Ben's poetry especially, you can see just how magnificent the universe he was exploring was, while at the same time he was living a life of sort of, I suppose, quiet desperation. I'll let Elise talk more about that if we need to, but it's to me it's very important to bring it all back to a form, to a structure, to bring that flight of madness back, and sometimes that can take years to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Elise, something that really struck me when I was researching Ben's work and listening to the Radio National documentary that you were a part of, is there's this incredible sense of lineage. And listening to his work, I feel like I hear so much of Stein, so much of Ginsberg, but then something completely new as well. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Ben's reading practice, really, what he did in terms of reading and how that informed his writing.
Right. Well, he read very voraciously, and sometimes he would be up all night reading and writing, especially if he had a cigarette in one hand and a pen in the other. He was very happy. He particularly liked Blake. He loved Ginsberg. He saw Ginsberg as his poetic father. He also liked the work of Derrida. He liked the work of Antonin Artaud. And Artaud had, you know, experiences of madness himself. But through reading some of Artaud's work, this could actually bring Ben undone into a kind of almost a psychosis. But I guess, you know, Ben was trying to explore the relationship between the subconscious coming into the consciousness. So what appears symbolic and metaphoric in his work is actually a literal translation of his own mad experiences. So he saw the poet as almost like a priest, kind of going into Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, where he saw poetry as confession, and also performance poetry as exorcism. So he enjoyed reading because that was his kind of exorcism. He also saw having experiences of paranoia as the unconscious trying to merge with the subconscious. So he referred to his paranoia as like a black magical ritual spell and a hex cast. So he was definitely tapping into, you know, something otherworldly. And when we talk about the poem The Argument, we can see the journey that he's going from the subconscious merging into the conscious. So I'll talk about that a bit later, but yeah, I definitely think he was trying to merge the two worlds.
Yeah, and maintain control even as he was sometimes spinning out of control, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. And as Tim was referring to before, you know, the moods that can sometimes accompany madness or, you know, accessing other kind of dimensions, particularly that could happen in post-traumatic stress disorder where people disassociate. I think, yeah, he was trying to maintain a level of control and bring those worlds together. So as Tim was talking about before, trying to, you know, bring structure back, like not just having these rantings of some madman lunatic, but actually, you know, bringing it all together, piecing it all together so it forms some kind of structure.
It's bigger than you, and you are not me. The lengths that I will go to, the distance in your eyes.
Thank you. The second poem is the guts of this book. It's the incantation section. And it begins like this. The dreamer who butchered his arm to challenge his reality now butchers his reality to challenge his arm. My forearm is a wounded shark, a crippled highway, an imaginary tool, a nocturnal ballad of hieroglyphs, a battered bird wing, a supplicator, a bleeding ghost, the end of a lion's tyranny, an ancient crocodile skull, the nightmare and war of spring, a Catholic yak's exorcism. My forearm is our golden fingerless child, a piece of apocalyptic debris, has closed eyelids, is an anti-American warcraft, the memory of wild horses, its own executioner. My forearm is hell's kiss of smothered lips, your lack of perception, the rage of a blind salamander, a voyeur while I sleep, a breastless woman and a toothless old man tapping his foot to the rhythmic convulsions of a dead ocean. My forearm is the active desires of Akhenaten, the left wing of Christ, the right fist of Allah, and a Sanskrit stitch part. My forearm is the blood-black sunrise, the mind that eats your leg. My forearm is tomorrow's bitch, today's whore, and last night's insomniac. A gutted reptile forces electricity down the blue throat, is an arrow dreamt beyond this cell, a Chinese red rhapsody, an African gunrunner, an alcoholic automobile. My forearm is our unclear nuclear future, bleeds its own delight. My forearm is the culmination of hissing apples and rotten skin. My forearm breathes through incisions, also known as gills. My forearm is Marvel's dog, a bashed cherub, a thick vibrating web of agony, liar and tomb, a Miltonian mutiny that groans toward the heavens. My forearm is the unfurled dragon abdomen with its five heads of blood and gristle. My forearm is a cut worm and blind maggot, a desperate corpse and rabid carcass, desires the god of panicked birds and difficult pyramids, a sleepless cannibal, a liturgy of psychotic hooks displacing my mental weight, and suspends me nowhere in imagination. My forearm is a meek neck waiting for the last train. Our long red guillotine bears the burden of backyard industry. Witness the locust under Paul's eyelids. Depicts a dappled sky and sickly horizon. Will inoculate your reams of dreams. Leaves your clitoral gland yowling for more legs. My forearm remains defiant in the face of CBT and ECT. Cannot lose or loose this raw shackle, a pillar of assassination and masturbation. My forearm is a burning song stick, a pretermortem Islamic nocturne, a bulging dead fetus, a deformed tiger eye. My forearm is a syntactical activist, eats its own sores and admires the half-baked moon. My forearm is my brother, a kangaroo blood colt, mad hairless dog. My forearm is more raw mind. My forearm stinks of shark flesh, feels underbelly stingray sex, with holes, moray, eel, masturbation, and all the corporal grandeur of marinary mating. My forum is the chant of a dead nun, a tortured priest, and dying llama. My forearm is the living memory of bleeding veins and beating wings.
The argument is very much a poem that builds on through what Elise has called, I think, post-traumatic stress. And I understand Ben had a lot of that in his life, growing up in a difficult relationship with his dad, Howard, who leased hotels around Campbelltown and different places. And the impact of trauma on an individual, and then how one brings that, makes sense of that, I suppose. And often we understand now, I suppose, in the structure that we call diagnostic mental health disorders, we can call Ben's illness schizophrenia, or we can call it a reaction to what's happened to him in his life, and the manifestation of the paranoia and voices and things that come with that as being a pretty normal human reaction to what's happened. So I just see this poem as being someone who has that, you know, need to almost self-harm, but at the same time to proclaim. And so it's just an incredible poem. I just think it's I think the first time I heard it was on when the radio documentary 360 documentary was released on RN in 2012, and it just was incredible to hear someone, as one of many poems that and many stories in that documentary, to hear someone who could be so magnificent in retelling and reshaping those experiences of pain, the need to, the feeling that one feels like self-harming to move forward. Ben's voice was so strong, and then when I looked up the videos and saw him reading it at what was a Mad Pride concert in Campbelltown in 2006. Just the energy, the passion, everything about this person was incredible. But I think the structure was just so much, it wasn't the illness anymore, it was just the structure was just the flight of imagination and creativity and all those poets that Elise has mentioned, who came into this poem, and it was just so rich with powerful images. But, you know, to me it was an affirmation of what I'd been doing, because I hadn't heard any local, because he was, you know, he went to Wollongong Uni, and I'm here only a couple of kilometres away from Wollongong Uni, and I'm hearing this mad poet go for it. And it was just incredibly affirming to the work that I've been doing with my own poetry. And then I think the structure, a different sort of structure, was then, you know, 2 years ago at an event, a consumer worker event run by Douglas Holmes in Sydney, where Elise read and Ben read and I read, and it all came together. There was just so much bringing us together around this person and this sort of poetry. So,
and it's interesting that you say affirmation, because that's exactly the word that I wrote down after listening to this. And I also wrote down the word celebration, even though it's a poem that is, it does seem to have a violence and, as you say, tending towards the area of self-harm. There are lines in there like, my forearm is a burning song stick, a syntactical activist, my brother, more raw mind. There's something celebratory in that. Would you agree with that, Elise, or am I going off on a strange tangent there?
No, absolutely, yeah. There's a lot of life that's coming out. It's not all, one big kind of trauma horror story. He was very close to his brother Matthew, and he would refer to him as an alabaster Aborigine. So he was definitely an inspiration for Ben's work. Also, he belonged to a group called the Syntactical Activists while he was at university. They were a small group of poets, which I think, really encouraged him to write. So, there's a lot to be celebrated about it. There's a line in there that says that an African gun runner, of course, that's referring to Arthur Rimbaud, who was quite an inspiration to Ben as well. There's a lot in the poem that is celebratory. So,
yeah, and there's an excess as well as a control.
Yeah, so in a way it is balanced, even if it's kind of in a chaotically balanced way. So this appeared in his first publication, Bug House Meat, which was published by Bird in the Mouth Press with his colleague Rob Wilson. So this book was already published before I actually met him at university. And I remember he would go around his father's pub trying to sell it for a very mild $10, as he described it. And he would go around bookshops in Wollongong and also in the Sydney suburbs and, ask them if they could stock it for him because he really wanted to get his work out there.
Wow, so he was hustling. He was really going for it.
Yes, yeah, he was hustling, yeah.
Yeah.
He did talk about it a bit. I mean, I notice in the poem there's a lot of references to ancient Egypt. He talks about hieroglyphs, a lion's tyranny, references to golden, Akhenaten, Sanskrit. There's also allusions to money alchemy in the line A Chinese Red Rhapsody. Also where he says my forearm forces electricity down the blue throat, he's referring to the 12 sessions of ECT that he had, which he said that left him with huge chunks and gaps in his memory, so much so that he couldn't remember like years of his life.
Said the Gnostic skeleton, the human forms divine. Said the Christian coalition skeleton, no, it's not, it's mine. Said the Buddha skeleton, compassion is wealth. Said the corporate skeleton, it's bad for your health. Said the old Christ skeleton, care for the poor. Said the Son of God skeleton, AIDS needs cure. Said the homophobe skeleton, gay folks suck. Said the heritage policy skeleton, blacks are out of luck.
He believed a lot in chance and automatic writing, and he really liked Allen Ginsberg's idea that the first thought was the best thought. So whatever first popped into your head, that would be, the truest thing, and you should get it out. So he kind of loved the accidental and chance. He wanted to produce work that was both spiritual and also commenting on society. He used to say that prose was a waste of language, and that poetry was a much truer medium because it cuts through the unnecessary, and it gets to the very essence of things, to the truth of the matter. So he never wrote in the prose medium. He always wrote poetry.
The subheading to the argument sort of sums up, I think, what Ben was trying to do, which is about saying, I suppose, what's more important, what's real? Is it the illness, or is it the things that you can see that perhaps the illness brings, or something else brings? But the subtitle, "The Dreamer Who Butchered His Arm to Challenge His Reality," now butchers his reality to challenge his arm. So, you know, this idea of wounding a forearm, of cutting, I suppose, is a common, a thing that happens, I suppose, with mental illness. And it's about this act is there, it happens, it seems terrible, but the balance of the poem is just so huge on the other side of the forearm, the things that Ben brings out to us, his magnificent world, beginning with the wounded shark, the crippled highway, an imaginary tool.
And you measure for wealth by the things you can hold. And you measure for love by the sweet things you're told. And you live in the past of a dream that you're in.
And it's been a long walk with this idea of talking about madness through poetry. And that's why I was attracted to Ben, I think, and to Elise. It's just amazing that after this time you suddenly hear this really immediate strong voice, and then you discover that the man has passed away, but Elise is still there, and we're still trying to get that out. But yeah, so my poems, as I said, some are about madness and some are about other things, so we'll go with this one. So what made it into Verity La was four stanzas of a larger poem. And it's around the experiences of what people call psychosis. It's about the belief I had, emerging belief that I had some ability to save the world. I thought the world was going to end. It was the middle of the Cold War. In 1983, it was Ronald Reagan, Star Wars, it was the invasion of Grenada, it was the downing of KAL-007 over the Korean airliner over Russia. There are a whole lot of things that conspired to trip my world, which I suppose into a delusional belief system. And with bipolar, manic depression, it's very seductive to move into this space. So the poem was originally published in a little online, an online e-zine called Thylazine, which was curated by Coral Hull in 2007. And somehow Michelle and I connected over some poems I published in another journal, and she was keen for me to get some poems out of the drawer. So I got this one out, and I've turned it into, in Verity Lara, into a prose poem, even though it rhymes, and it's sort of a contradiction, a rhyming prose poem, but I think that's the rhyme was intentional, and it's the only poem I think I've ever written with rhyme, in that it impels the reader, the sayer, to move forward through the poem. There's no going back. It's just to me it's a thing that just moves the poem forward. And yeah, so it was an interesting time, but it also was a very special thing about how the experiences of madness also intersects with the reality of things happening in the world, and how sometimes poets who are a bit mad can bring out of the ether the connections that are real and tap into things that are happening. So the poem actually, sometime after I got out of the ward the first time, when I thought I was saving the world because it was going to implode in a nuclear apocalypse, I found out some years later that actually there was a major nuclear scare at the identical time that I was in hospital. And it was a little escapade called Abel Archer, but that's another story. So this poem is Reasonable Delusions of a Religious Nature. Walking. Reality or phantasmagoria, desperate love on a rented bed, insanity or elated perception, a numbed litany that will be said. Lie that winter freezing on oil-stained concrete. She would not let you in nor anoint your wearied feet. Dreams escape from nighttime, persuading you to begin to see the visions from without as the visions from within. Lyrics spiral from your head and you tell that they too would see, but your mind is jammed on 45 while the world revolves on 33. Thirsting for guidance at 4 a.m. you tear the news from blinding twine. This will be your medium now that you are drawn to the dividing line. Spit syllables at your father and blaspheme the missing lord in the antiseptic stench of some sterile casualty ward. Wake up in an ambulance moving somewhere they won't explain. Escort lights pulse blues ahead and charge the wiper scourging rain. Pause in a halfway hospital and repel the dribbling syringe. Feel the weight of mocking wardsmen, needle stabs to make you cringe. Strip past your nakedness once they've pushed and shoved you in. Squat in the blurred baptismal bath while some angel records your sin. Smile weeping in the rec room as music sings your fame. Each new lyric is offered in devotion to your name. Cue for madhouse confectionery fed from gleaming stainless steel. Pick me up on obscured mornings at nighttime so you won't feel. Attempt to read her letters through dazed, dilating eyes. You cannot write the answers, as you know that someone lies. Walk rigidly with Parkinson. You are dealt another pill to counter common side effects of chemicals that hold mine still. Slouch the light time in a stupor in between the times you are fed. You wish to obliterate the hours before escape a Ward 12 bed. You look into a mirror and recollect a face, confess your grand delusion, leave this unholy place. Promises of Armageddon to be unleashed when you were dead. The asylum had been your shelter. The atoms split inside your head. Read 6 sane years later how we just missed World War III. This was your mad delusion. Is it truth that you now see? Each springtime sense the surge of seesaw swings to be swung. Tranquilized sensations so these spring songs can't be sung. It's sometimes difficult when you move into this space and have to navigate medication and life and work and family and recovery and all those things. I think with my experience of bipolar, often the springtime surge, the increase in light can bring on that hypomanic state. But I think the spring songs, the ability to just to say this stuff and as I said, to bring it into the mainstream poetic world, I suppose, to try and make it stuff that gets out there and gets into journals is important. But it's always a fight between the difficulty of being creative when you have this stuff going on, and you know, moving with the swing, I suppose. Bipolar's all about mood swings, so that's probably why I put the seesaw swings. There's great beauty and meaning, and I wouldn't have any of my life differently, as most people would, because I think this experience that we have is truly our own experience. It does give us insights, it does give us connections, it does sort of allow us to sometimes get our thought waves out there into those vibrations that are happening around the world that are often invisible to other people that you can connect to. And so there's a lot of connectivity and synchronicity and that happens with this. And I'm glad sometimes I can bring it down to a piece of writing. This is an old poem, redone, but it's a special poem. Was probably a very important piece of work in my own recovery to make sense of some pretty confronting experiences of being involuntarily hospitalized and experiencing things like seclusion and restraint and forced sedation and those sorts of things. So it was important to me. I'd just like to probably concur with Sylvia Plath, who said before she wrote The Bell Jar, and this is the imperative about writing this stuff, she wrote in a journal, apparently, I must write one about a college girl's suicide, and a story, a novel even. There is an increasing market for mental hospital stuff. I'm a fool if I don't recreate it. So I think there's definitely a market, increasing market for mental hospital stuff. So that goes back to Sylvia Plath prior to 1971 when she published The Bell Jar from her journal. But it's I think the intersection of, you know, I don't want to romanticise it, as Elise was saying. But I do think there's a fine walk we walk, where that movement from where does creativity come from, and then where does madness start? There's a sort of a link there, I suppose. But I think we've got to understand that in some ways madness is a very important state of being, especially in the type of world we live in today, where we accept and live with societal, political madness every day, and yet we condemn and incarcerate people with individual madness sometimes, supposedly because they're at risk to themselves or some other people, whereas we condone and let happen this global madness that's happening at the moment. I just think it's so important to let people with a different way of connecting with the planet and the universe and a different way of saying it, to say it. And I think poetry is just such an incredible way to do it.
Step one, you say we need to talk. He walks, you say sit down, it's just talk. He smiles politely back at you. You stare politely right on through some sort of window to it.